From Intellijix, this is Intellijix True Crime. Today, three true cases, each one investigated, tried, and closed. Let's begin. There is a moment, documented in the trial record, that seems to contain an entire marriage in miniature. A young woman sits for a photograph holding her 9-month-old daughter. The baby is wearing a soft white outfit, and the mother is smiling, not the performed smile people offer when a camera appears, but the unguarded, slightly tired, wholly genuine smile of someone who believes, in that instant, that everything she worked for has finally arrived. The photograph was taken in January of 2006, in a rented house on a quiet street in Hopkinton, Massachusetts. Within days of that picture being taken, Rachel Entwistle and her daughter Lillian would be dead. And the man who took the photograph, the man Rachel had trusted with her entire future, was already, according to prosecutors, planning to make sure of it. Rachel Souza grew up in Carver, Massachusetts, a small town southeast of Boston, where cranberry bogs stretch flat to the horizon and everybody knows your family's name. By all accounts from those who loved her, she was the kind of person a community builds its identity around, warm, funny, quietly determined. She had studied at Worcester State College, and friends described her as someone who brought a kind of practical optimism to everything she attempted. She wanted to teach. She wanted a family. She had, her mother Priscilla Matarazzo would later tell reporters through barely controlled grief, an enormous capacity for loyalty. She met Neil Entwistle while she was studying abroad in England, and the match seemed, on its surface, to be exactly the sort of story people tell at rehearsal dinners. He was charming, British, apparently well-educated, and he talked about the future with a confidence that Rachel found reassuring. They married. They moved together to the United States, settling eventually into a house at 6 Cubs Path in Hopkinton, a tidy, leafy suburb west of Boston, the kind of town that ends marathons and raises families. In August of 2005, Lillian Rose Entwistle was born, 9 months old at the time of her death. 9 months old and just beginning, by all family accounts, to become her own small person. What Rachel did not know, what prosecutors would spend considerable time establishing at trial, was that the life her husband had constructed around them was in significant part a fiction. It was Sunday, January 22, 2006, that the first alarm sounded. Rachel's stepfather, Joseph Matarazzo, tried repeatedly to reach his stepdaughter by phone. No answer. Her mother tried as well. This was not like Rachel, not on a Sunday, not when she had a 9-month-old who set the rhythm of every hour. The family drove to Hopkinton. They knocked. They found the house quiet in a way that felt wrong. Joseph Matarazzo called 911. Hopkinton police officers arrived and entered the home. What they discovered in a downstairs bedroom beneath a pile of bedding was Rachel Entwistle, 27 years old, and baby Lillian, still in her mother's arms. Both had been shot. Investigators would later determine that both had been killed by a single bullet fired from a .22 caliber pistol, the gun positioned in close proximity to the victims. The medical examiner's findings established that Lillian had been shot first, or nearly simultaneously with her mother. There was no sign of struggle. There was no sign of forced entry. The house was otherwise undisturbed. Neil Entwistle was not there. Neil Entwistle, it emerged within hours, was not in the country. He had boarded a flight to England on January 20th, 2 days before his family's bodies were discovered, at least a day after investigators would conclude the murders had occurred. He had driven a rented BMW to Logan Airport. He had left his wife and daughter. He had gotten on a plane. What followed was a transatlantic investigation that drew the attention of federal and state authorities on both sides of the ocean, and eventually the sustained attention of the entire country. Hopkinton police, working with the Massachusetts State Police and the FBI, began pulling apart Neil Entwistle's life with the methodical patience that serious investigations require. What they found, layer by layer, was a portrait of a man who had built his marriage and his identity on foundations that were quietly collapsing. The financial picture was the first revelation. According to prosecutors, Neil Entwistle had represented himself, both to Rachel and to the world, as a successful internet entrepreneur. He had, court records show, been operating a series of online schemes. programs that purported to teach users how to make money online, software that was later characterized in legal proceedings as essentially fraudulent. He owed money. He was behind on the rent for the Hopkinton house. According to prosecutors, the financial pressure he was under was severe and accelerating. The marital picture that emerged was not simple either. Court records indicated that Neil Entwistle had been conducting online communications of a sexual nature with other women. Whether Rachel knew the full extent of this is not documented. What is documented is that investigators found no evidence she was preparing to leave him, no evidence of a formal separation, no evidence that she had confronted him in any way that precipitated an immediate crisis. By all appearances documented in the trial record, Rachel Entwistle was committed to her marriage and devoted to her daughter. Then came the internet searches. This was the evidentiary turning point, the moment that shifted the investigation from a tragic mystery into something prosecutors believe they could prove beyond a reasonable doubt. Forensic analysis of computers associated with Neil Entwistle revealed a series of searches conducted in the period before the murders. According to testimony presented at trial, those searches included queries about how to kill a person and, strikingly, searches for the services of a hitman. Investigators testified that the searches preceded the deaths of Rachel and Lillian Entwistle. The prosecution's theory, articulated clearly in opening statements and supported throughout trial, was that Neil Entwistle had, in the days before the murders, been researching how to have his family killed and then had done it himself. There was also the matter of the gun. The .22 caliber pistol used in the killings was traced to Rachel's stepfather, Joseph Matarazzo, who kept it legally at the family home in Carver. Neil Entwistle had been to that home with Rachel in the days before the murders. He knew where the weapon was kept, investigators testified. The gun itself was never recovered, but ballistic evidence tied the ammunition used to the same type as rounds found in the Matarazzo home. While the investigation accelerated in Massachusetts, Neil Entwistle had arrived in England and was staying with his parents in Worksop, Nottinghamshire. He gave an interview to British police, voluntarily, before an extradition request had even been formally issued, in which, according to reports from that interview later introduced at trial, he described returning home, finding his family dead, and fleeing in a panic to England. He claimed he had been so overcome that he could not bring himself to call for help. He claimed he had simply run. Prosecutors would characterize this explanation as deeply implausible. They noted that in the days after his arrival in England, Neil Entwistle did not contact American police. He did not call Rachel's family. He did not make any effort, documented or otherwise, to learn more about what had happened to his wife and daughter. He waited in his parents' house while the world searched for him. Extradition proceedings moved with relative efficiency, given the gravity of the case and the cooperation of British authorities. Neil Entwistle was returned to the United States in February of 2006. He was arraigned and held without bail. He pleaded not guilty to two counts of first-degree murder. The trial of Neil Entwistle began in June of 2008 in Middlesex County Superior Court. It lasted approximately 3 weeks. The case that prosecutors built was circumstantial in architecture, but dense in detail. A structure assembled from digital forensics, ballistic analysis, financial records, and the testimony of those who had known both Neil and Rachel Entwistle. The defense, led by attorney Elliot Weinstein, worked to create reasonable doubt around the central question of whether Neil Entwistle had committed the murders or whether someone else had entered that home. The defense also challenged the credibility of the internet search evidence and questioned the reliability of forensic conclusions. Weinstein suggested, in closing arguments, that the evidence was not sufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that his client had pulled the trigger. The prosecution had a different argument. They told the jury that the internet searches spoke directly to Neil Entwistle's state of mind in the days before the killings. They presented testimony about his financial desperation. They presented testimony about the gun's origin. They presented, perhaps most powerfully, the simple fact of his flight, that within what prosecutors argued were hours of killing his wife and infant daughter, Neil Entwistle had gotten into a car, driven to an airport, and left the country without calling 911, without calling Rachel's family, without telling a single person that something terrible had happened at Six Cubs Path. One piece of physical evidence the prosecution highlighted was a DNA finding. According to testimony presented at trial, a forensic analysis of the bedding covering the victims identified a DNA profile consistent with Neil Entwistle's. He had been in that bed. He had been, prosecutors argued, the last person with Rachel and Lillian before they died. On June 26, 2008, the jury returned its verdict, guilty, on both counts. Two counts of first-degree murder, deliberate premeditation. Neil Entwistle was sentenced to two consecutive terms of life in prison without the possibility of parole. He would not speak at sentencing. He showed, observers in the courtroom noted, very little visible reaction. Rachel's mother, Priscilla Matarazzo, did speak. She addressed the court with a dignity that the moment almost couldn't contain. She described her daughter's warmth. She described Lillian, 9 months old, just beginning. She said what any mother in that position might say, and the courtroom held it. The legal proceedings did not end with the verdict, as they rarely do in cases of this magnitude. Neil Entwistle pursued appeals through the Massachusetts court system. His attorneys raised a number of issues on appeal, including arguments related to the admission of certain evidence and questions about the conduct of the investigation and trial. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, the state's highest court, reviewed the case and in 2012 issued a decision upholding the conviction in full. The court found that the evidence presented at trial was sufficient to support the jury's finding of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and that the legal issues raised on appeal did not warrant reversal. Neil Entwistle remains incarcerated, serving his two consecutive life sentences without possibility of parole. There is no legal mechanism that could change that outcome, absent extraordinary circumstances that, as of the record available, have not emerged. Cases like this one tend to generate, in the years after their resolution, a particular kind of public fixation, an effort to understand how a marriage, how a family, how a man could conceal so much for so long. The internet searches, the financial schemes, the apparent normalcy of the household on Cubs Path, all of it becomes material for a kind of forensic reconstruction that tries to answer the question of when exactly things went wrong. But that question, however understandable, is perhaps the wrong one to carry away, because what the documented record of this case ultimately centers is not Neil Entwistle's psychology. It is Rachel, a young woman from Carver, Massachusetts, who wanted to teach, who wanted a family, who loved her daughter with the uncomplicated fierceness that 9 months of motherhood produces. Lillian Rose, who was 9 months old, who had done nothing, who was by every account adored by the people around her. The prosecution, in its closing argument, asked the jury to remember that Rachel and Lillian Entwistle could not speak for themselves in that courtroom, that the only voices they had were the evidence and the people who had loved them. The jury listened. The jury found, and the appellate court confirmed, that the evidence was sufficient, that the facts, assembled carefully and tested rigorously, told a story the law could act upon. Rachel Entwistle's family has, in the years since, maintained a careful and largely private grief. They have not sought the spotlight. They have not, as far as the documented record shows, done anything other than try to carry forward the memory of a daughter and a granddaughter who deserved to grow old, who deserved the ordinary and extraordinary years that were taken from them on a quiet street in a quiet town at the beginning of a new year. There is a photograph, a mother in an unremarkable room, holding her baby, smiling the way you only smile when you think no one is really watching. It is the kind of image that, once you know what comes after it, becomes almost impossible to look at directly. But it is also perhaps the truest record this story has, not the searches, not the flight, not the courtroom, but that room, that baby, that smile. Rachel Entwistle, alive and present, holding the thing she loved most in the world, not yet knowing anything was wrong. Our next case takes us to Lincoln City, Oregon. The phone call came on a January morning in 1990, and by the time Lincoln County detectives reached the ravine off Highway 30 near the Columbia River Gorge, The cold Oregon air had already done its quiet, terrible work. A woman's body had been found at the base of a steep embankment, partially concealed by the winter gray brush that lines those coastal roads. She was young. She was someone's daughter. And within days, investigators believed they knew who had killed her, a belief that would prove catastrophically, heartbreakingly wrong, and would take the better part of a decade to fully correct. Her name was Tonja Bennett. She was 23 years old. People who knew Tonja remembered her as someone who moved through the world with a kind of unguarded warmth, the sort of person who would strike up a conversation with a stranger and mean every word of it. She had grown up in the Portland area, and those who loved her described a young woman who had faced real challenges in her life. She had cognitive difficulties that sometimes made navigating the world harder than it needed to be, but who met those challenges with a resilience that impressed the people around her. She liked to go out. She liked music and people, and the particular electricity of a crowded bar on a weekend night. She was not naive so much as trusting, and there is a difference, though the world does not always honor it. On the evening of January 21, 1990, Tonja Bennett was at a tavern in northeast Portland called B&I Tavern. She was seen there by multiple witnesses, and at some point during that evening, she left, or was last seen, in the company of a man. What happened next would not be fully and accurately understood for years. Her body was discovered not far from the gorge, and the manner of her death told investigators that someone had done something brutal and deliberate. The cause of death was determined to be homicidal violence. She had been killed, and her killer had driven her body to that lonely stretch of road and left her there, perhaps believing the geography would do what time and silence so often do: swallow the truth whole. Lincoln County and Multnomah County investigators began working the case with the urgency that a young woman's violent death demands. And then, within months, something happened that seemed to resolve the matter entirely, something that would turn out to be one of the most stunning miscarriages of justice in Oregon's modern history. A woman named Laverne Pavlinak came forward and told police that her boyfriend, John Sosnovsky, had killed Tonja Bennett. Pavlinak provided details. She described the crime. She eventually pleaded guilty to being an accomplice, and Sosnovsky, maintaining his innocence, was convicted at trial. Both of them went to prison. Multnomah County prosecutors and investigators, working from what appeared to be a solid confession with corroborating detail, closed the case. Tonja Bennett's family was told the man responsible was behind bars, except that he wasn't. What investigators could not have fully known in those early years, what the technology of the time did not yet allow them to know with certainty, was that the real killer had left something of himself at the scene, biological evidence. The kind that, if properly analyzed and compared, would one day speak with a precision that no confession, however detailed, could match or contradict. In the meantime, a man named Jesse Calhoun was living his life in Lincoln City, Oregon, a coastal town of about 8,000 people, tucked between Silas Bay and the Pacific Ocean, where the dunes roll toward the water, and the summer tourists come and go, and the full-time residents know one another's business the way people do in small places. Calhoun was known locally. He was not a ghost or a phantom. He moved through that community in the years after Tonja Bennett's death, while another man sat in prison for what prosecutors would eventually conclude Jesse Calhoun had done. The Pavlinak-Sosnovsky case began to unravel because of Laverne Pavlinak herself. She had, according to subsequent court proceedings and extensive reporting on the case, fabricated her confession, not out of some inexplicable impulse, but because, she later explained, she had wanted to escape an abusive relationship with Sosnovsky and had believed that implicating him in a murder was the only way out. She had constructed her account carefully enough, drawing on details from newspaper coverage of the case, that investigators had found it credible. The system, as systems sometimes do, had taken her at her word. In 1994, Pavlinak recanted. She told authorities she had lied. The process of unwinding the convictions moved through Oregon's courts, and in November of 1995, Governor John Kitzhaber granted clemency to both Laverne Pavlinak and John Sosnovsky. they were released. Sosnovsky had spent years in prison for a crime he did not commit. Pavlinac, who had confessed, was also freed. It was, by any measure, a profound institutional failure, and it reopened the question that had never truly been answered: who killed Tonya Bennett? The reinvestigation moved with the kind of renewed urgency that a case of this magnitude demands. Investigators returned to the physical evidence, evidence that had been collected at the scene in 1990, preserved through years of what turned out to be a wrongful prosecution, and now available for the kind of analysis that had not been practically possible when the case first broke. DNA technology had advanced considerably by the mid-1990s. What might have been inconclusive or unavailable in 1990 was now, 5 years later, a genuine investigative tool. Detectives began looking again at the Portland bar where Tonya Bennett had spent her last evening. They re-interviewed witnesses. They looked at who she might have left with, who had been seen near her, who might have had both the opportunity and any documented connection to what had happened. The investigation fanned outward in the methodical way that cold case work often does, following threads that had gone unpulled while two innocent people were absorbing the consequences of a crime committed by someone else. Jesse Calhoun's name emerged in the course of that renewed investigation. The precise path by which investigators arrived at him, which witnesses they spoke to, which records they reviewed, was detailed in court proceedings and in the reporting that followed, though as with many active criminal investigations, not every step was made immediately public. What is documented is that Calhoun became a suspect, and that once he was a suspect, investigators moved to obtain a biological sample for DNA comparison. The results were, according to court records and the prosecutors who presented them at trial, unambiguous. Jesse Calhoun's DNA matched biological evidence recovered from Tonya Bennett's body. It was the kind of evidence that does not equivocate, that does not rely on memory or motive or the interpretive fog that surrounds so much of what happens in bars and on roadsides late at night. It was, in the language that science uses when it speaks most clearly, a match. Jesse Calhoun was arrested and charged with the aggravated murder of Tonya Bennett. The case went to trial, and the prosecution's argument rested on the convergence of the DNA evidence with other details of the investigation. Prosecutors argued that Calhoun had encountered Tonya Bennett at or near the BNI Tavern on the night of January 21, 1990, and that what followed was a deliberate act of violence that ended her life. The aggravated murder charge under Oregon law reflected the specific circumstances of the killing, the elements that elevated it beyond murder in the first degree. Calhoun's defense confronted the particular difficulty of DNA evidence. It is not easily dismissed, not easily reframed. Defense attorneys in DNA cases sometimes challenge the collection, handling, or analysis of samples, the chain of custody, the laboratory procedures, the statistical interpretation of a match. The record of the trial reflects a proceeding in which the physical evidence was central and in which the jury was asked to weigh what the science said against whatever alternative explanation the defense might offer. The jury found Jesse Calhoun guilty of aggravated murder. He was sentenced to life in prison, a sentence that in Oregon means what it says, without the possibility of parole that might one day return him to the streets of Lincoln City or anywhere else. There is a detail about this case that sits apart from the ordinary architecture of crime and consequence, and it is worth pausing to consider it with the weight it deserves. Laverne Pavlinac, the woman who fabricated the confession that sent an innocent man to prison, did not confess to a crime she witnessed or participated in. She invented a crime from newspaper clippings and desperation. She named a real person, John Sosnovsky, and wrapped her fabrication around him, and the system received it and processed it and incarcerated him. This is not a story about a clever criminal who planted evidence or orchestrated an elaborate frame. It is in some ways more troubling than that. It is a story about how a system designed to find truth can be led astray by a false confession that is detailed enough to seem credible, and about the gap between seeming credible and being true. John Sosnovsky spent years of his life in a prison cell. His case is studied now in law schools and journalism programs and criminal justice reform discussions as an example of the dangers of confession evidence without sufficient corroboration. And Tonja Bennett's family, her mother, her siblings, the people who loved her, lived for 5 years believing they knew who had taken her from them, and then had to absorb the information that they did not know, that the real answer was still somewhere out there, still unresolved. That particular grief, the grief of a case that seemed closed and then opened again like a wound, is something that doesn't translate easily into legal language or appellate records. It lives in the people who carry it. After his conviction, Jesse Calhoun pursued the appeals that the law provides to those who have been found guilty. Oregon's appellate courts reviewed the record as they are required to do, and the conviction was upheld. The DNA evidence, the trial record, the conduct of the prosecution, none of it, upon review, provided grounds for reversal. Calhoun remained in custody, his appeals exhausted in the way that appeals eventually are when the record does not support them. As of the most recently available public records and reporting on the case, Jesse Calhoun is serving his life sentence in the Oregon Department of Corrections. He has not been released. There is no mechanism under Oregon law by which he would be eligible for parole on an aggravated murder conviction, and no subsequent legal development has altered his status. The Pavlinak-Sosnovsky wrongful conviction, meanwhile, entered the record of American criminal justice as one of its more instructive cautionary tales. John Sosnovsky, exonerated and released, sought to rebuild a life that the system had taken from him. Laverne Pavlinak, whose recantation ultimately freed him, died in 2003, having lived out the years after her release under the shadow of what she had set in motion. The state of Oregon, in the years following the case, examined its procedures for evaluating confession evidence, and the case has been cited repeatedly in discussions of wrongful convictions and the reforms needed to prevent them. What is left, when the appeals are done and the courtrooms are quiet, is the life that was lost and the lives that were changed, and the long, winding distance between the moment of a crime and the moment justice is finally delivered. Tonja Bennett was 23. She went out on a Sunday night in January to a bar in northeast Portland, and she never came home. She deserved better. Better from the world that failed to protect her, better from the system that initially convicted the wrong people and left the real answer unsettled for 5 additional years. What she got, eventually, was the truth. It came late, and it came by way of science rather than testimony, and it arrived in a courtroom in Oregon long after the world had moved on. But it came. Jesse Calhoun, the jury found, was the man who drove her to that ravine. He was the one who left her there in the January cold. He has been in prison since his conviction, and the law says he will remain there. There is a particular solemnity to cases like this one, cases where the wrong answer precedes the right one, where justice is not only delayed but initially misdirected. They remind us that the system is made of people, and people can be deceived, and the tools available in any given moment shape what is possible to know. In 1990, DNA analysis was not what it would become. In 1995, it was enough. For Tonja Bennett's family, the resolution must have felt like something complicated. Relief and grief and anger all wound together, arriving years past when they should have. For John Sosnovsky, exonerated but not unharmed, the word justice probably carries a different weight than it does for people who have only read about his case in a courtroom record. And for Jesse Calhoun, who spent 5 years watching someone else be prosecuted for what he had done before the science finally closed the distance between him and what happened on that January night, well, the jury found him guilty. The sentence was life. And in that small coastal town where the dunes meet the ocean and the tourists come and go with the seasons, someone who should have answered for Tonja Bennett's death a very long time ago is finally, definitively, doing so. Our next case takes us to Springfield, Illinois. There is a moment in the history of the Springfield, Illinois Police Department that investigators would later describe as one of the most painful reckonings they ever faced. The moment they realized they had looked at a grieving husband, shaken his hand, and walked away. It was August 29th, 1995. Officers arrived at a neat, two-story house on Westview Drive to find a scene that seemed, on its face, to tell its own story. A man named Roger Harrington lay dead on the floor, shot twice by the homeowner. Nearby, a young woman, the homeowner's wife, Donna Winger, lay dying from catastrophic blunt force injuries to her head. Her husband, Mark Winger, stood in the center of it all, shaking, cooperative, and apparently devastated. He told police that Harrington, the driver of a shuttle van Donna had used weeks earlier, had broken into the home, attacked his wife with a hammer, and that he had come downstairs and shot the man in defense of her. Donna was rushed to the hospital, where she died hours later without regaining consciousness. The story, as Mark Winger told it, was heartbreaking, and for more than 6 years, the people of Springfield, Illinois, believed every word of it. Donna Winger was, by every account from the people who knew her, the kind of person who made a room feel warmer the moment she walked in. Born Donna Brown, she had grown up in Florida and carried with her a brightness that friends described as entirely genuine. Not performed, not put on, but simply the way she was wired. She loved fiercely and laughed easily. And when she married Mark Winger in 1989, those who knew her said she threw herself into building a life with a wholehearted commitment that was entirely characteristic of her. She and Mark had struggled to have children of their own, and they had pursued adoption with the same determined hope. By the summer of 1995, they had brought home a baby girl named Bailey, and Donna was, by all accounts, radiant in her new role as a mother. She was 31 years old. In late July of 1995, Donna had taken a shuttle van service from the Springfield airport, driven by a man named Roger Harrington. The ride had unsettled her. Harrington, she later told friends and family, had behaved strangely, driving erratically, making odd and disturbing comments. She was shaken enough that she called the transportation company to complain, and she called Mark, and she called her friend Ira Drescher to talk through what had happened. She was frightened, but she was also safe, and the incident seemed like one of those jarring encounters with a stranger that fade in time. What Donna did not know, what no one outside of one very particular conversation would know for years, was that her husband had already been thinking about how to use Roger Harrington. Mark Winger, on the afternoon of August 29th, called the shuttle company before the murders occurred, according to investigators who later reconstructed the timeline. He left a message complaining about Harrington's conduct, a call that would initially seem like the act of a protective husband, but would later take on an entirely different significance. That evening, by Mark Winger's own account to police, he came downstairs to find Harrington beating Donna with a hammer. He retrieved his .45 caliber handgun and shot Harrington twice, killing him. Police arrived to find the hammer near Harrington's body, Donna mortally injured, and Mark Winger as the sole living witness to everything that had happened. Investigators from the Springfield Police Department examined the scene. What they found, they concluded at the time, was consistent with the story Mark Winger had told them. Roger Harrington, it emerged, had a history of emotional and psychological struggles. He had exhibited erratic behavior before. The hammer appeared to place him as the attacker. Within a relatively short period, the deaths of Donna Winger and Roger Harrington were ruled a double homicide. Harrington as the killer, Mark Winger as the man who had tragically been unable to save his wife but had stopped her attacker. Some within the community regarded him with a kind of sad admiration. He had done what a husband does. He had just been too late. Mark Winger's grief appeared, to those around him, to be genuine and consuming. He spoke publicly about Donna, about baby Bailey, about the loss he was carrying. And then, not quite a year after Donna's death, he remarried. Her name was Deanne, and she moved into the house on Westview Drive and helped raise Bailey. Life, as it appeared from the outside, had somehow continued. The thread that would eventually unravel everything began with a woman named Jessica Roach. In the late 1990s, Jessica came forward and contacted investigators with a story that, if true, reframed every assumption that had been made about August 29th, 1995. She and Mark Winger had been involved in an affair, she told them, an affair that had begun before Donna's death. And in the course of that relationship, she told investigators, Mark Winger had spoken to her about wanting Donna gone, about a plan. According to what she told authorities and later testified to in court, Mark had discussed using Roger Harrington as a way to stage a scenario, an intruder, a violent man who had already frightened Donna, who could be made to look like a killer. It was the kind of claim that on its own might not be enough. Affairs produce bitter allegations. Juries understand that. Prosecutors and investigators knew they needed more. What they found, when they went back and looked with new eyes, was that the physical evidence at the scene did not comfortably hold the shape of the story Mark Winger had told. Forensic reexamination of the scene, as detailed in court records and reporting by outlets, including the Chicago Tribune and the television news magazine Dateline NBC, raised serious questions about where Donna Winger had been struck and what that suggested about the sequence of events. Investigators found evidence suggesting that Donna had been attacked in a part of the house inconsistent with the scenario Mark described, that she had not simply encountered Harrington in a spontaneous assault, but had been struck in circumstances that pointed toward a different, more deliberate act. Prosecutors would argue at trial that Mark Winger had killed Donna himself, then shot Roger Harrington, a man who the state contended had been lured to the house, and arranged the scene to look like the result of an intruder's attack. The hammer, which had seemed so central to the original conclusion, now looked like a prop. The position of the bodies, the blood evidence, the trajectory of everything in that room, all of it, prosecutors argued, had been shaped by a man who understood that the story he told would only work if the evidence seemed to confirm it. There was something else. Investigators, reviewing old records, found a note that Donna had written to Mark, found in the house, which investigators would later describe as evidence of the couple's dynamics, and which became part of the picture prosecutors painted of a marriage that was not what it appeared to be from the outside. And then there was the matter of a witness who had been there, in a sense, all along. A neighbor who had spoken to investigators early on, whose account had not quite fit the timeline Mark described, whose recollections about the sequence of events, about when shots were heard, about sounds from the house, pointed toward a more troubling reality. When investigators returned to these details with the full weight of a reopened investigation, they began to construct a case that was no longer built on the testimony of a single, potentially aggrieved former girlfriend, but on a convergence of physical, forensic, and testimonial evidence. In 2001, Mark Winger was arrested and charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder, the murders of his wife, Donna Winger, and of Roger Harrington. Roger Harrington, the man who had been categorized for 6 years as a killer, was now, in the eyes of the law, a victim. The case went to trial in 2002 before a jury in Sangamon County, Illinois. The prosecution's case, as assembled by the state's attorney's office, was built on several interlocking pillars. Jessica Roach testified about the affair and about the conversations she said she had with Mark Winger before Donna's death. Conversations in which, she told the jury, he had spoken about wanting to be free of his marriage. Forensic experts testified about the physical evidence and why, in their professional judgment, the scene was inconsistent with the story of a husband who came downstairs to find an intruder attacking his wife. The prosecution argued, in the language of the court record, that Mark Winger had struck Donna with the hammer, and that when Roger Harrington arrived, for reasons that the state argued were connected to Mark having made contact with him, Mark shot him and then arranged the bodies and the scene before calling 911. The defense contested this account at every level. Mark Winger's attorneys challenged Jessica Roach's credibility and her motivations. They argued that the forensic interpretation was not as clear-cut as the prosecution suggested, and that the original conclusion, that Harrington was the attacker, remained a reasonable reading of the evidence. Mark Winger did not testify in his own defense. The jury deliberated and returned a verdict of guilty on both counts of first-degree murder. Mark Winger was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. He did not accept that verdict as final. In the years following his conviction, Winger pursued appeals through the Illinois court system, challenging aspects of the proceedings and the evidence against him. In 2007, an Illinois appellate court took up the case. Winger's legal team raised issues concerning the trial, but the appellate court affirmed the conviction. The Illinois Supreme Court declined to disturb that outcome. As documented in court records, Mark Winger has also, in subsequent years, been connected to another death, that of his former employer's wife, Betsy Bowman, who died in a fall from a hot air balloon in 1981 in circumstances that were, at the time, ruled an accident. After Winger's conviction for the 1995 murders, investigators and journalists revisited Bowman's death, and while no new charges were filed in connection with it, the case became part of the wider public record surrounding Mark Winger's history. It is worth saying clearly, no court has adjudicated Mark Winger's involvement in that earlier death, and it remains, in the legal record, an unresolved matter. What courts have adjudicated, finally and on appeal, is this. Mark Winger murdered Donna Winger and Roger Harrington on August 29, 1995, and he spent 6 years living as a free man, a grieving widower, a remarried father, while investigators operated on the assumption that the truth of that evening was exactly as he had described it. There is something worth sitting with in that, not to dramatize it, but to simply acknowledge the weight of it. Roger Harrington spent 6 years in death carrying the designation of killer. His own family, who knew him, who grieved him, who had their own complicated understanding of his struggles, carried that alongside their grief. When the truth, as the jury found it, finally emerged, it did not undo the years of that misunderstanding, but it did change what the record said about who Roger Harrington was. He was a man with difficulties, yes. He was not a murderer. And Donna Winger, who had called her friend after a frightening van ride, who had held her new baby daughter and believed her life was opening into something full and good, deserved to have her story told truly. For 6 years, the story told about her death was that it was random, terrible, the awful consequence of a chance encounter with a troubled stranger. The jury's finding said something different. It said she was killed by the person she trusted most, in the home they shared, on an ordinary afternoon. Bailey Winger grew up. After the conviction, she was raised by Donna's family, who had fought for years to see this case reopened, and who had never fully believed the original story. There is something in that, too. The persistence of people who love someone, who refuse to let the official version of events be the final version, who keep asking questions long past the point when it would have been easier to stop. The Springfield Police Department, for its part, has been the subject of significant scrutiny over the original investigation, over how a staged scene held together long enough to let a man walk away. Law enforcement professionals who have studied the case have pointed to it as an example of the dangers of confirmation bias in the early stages of an investigation, of how a plausible narrative, offered with apparent distress by a seemingly credible witness, can organize the perception of physical evidence in ways that take years to undo. Mark Winger remains in the custody of the Illinois Department of Corrections, serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole. His appeals have been exhausted. The conviction stands. Somewhere in that, there is the story of a woman named Donna who loved her daughter and lit up a room. The law finally said her name correctly. That's three cases for today. From all of us at Intelligix, thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.